From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
During the first half of the show, we'll be speaking with Sean Kelleher and Preston Campbell, the developer and general contractor of Echo Spur, a new eco-friendly community on Rossi Hill right here in Park City. We'll be talking about the sustainability features that they incorporated into the development, those that they tried to incorporate, and where they stand now.
That's right. And then in the second half of the show, we'll talk about Summit Community PowerWorks launch of their LED switch program. Why should we consider switching out our existing incandescent bulbs for new, more efficient lighting?
We'll discuss some of the myths and misperceptions surrounding LEDs and incandescent bulbs with Mary Krista Smith, the project manager of the Summit Community PowerWorks.
That's right. All that and some news on how warm Utah was during the year 2014. Warmer than you expect, I believe. Warmer than I thought.
Definitely.
We'll give you the details there. And why Petco is pulling its China-produced pet treats from their shelves, finally.
Sounds like a wise decision.
Yeah, that's why I say finally.
You can join in on today's conversation with both of our guests by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Some of the world's up-and-coming filmmakers will be in Park City for the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, and you can find out all about their newest projects. Tune into KPCW every weekday morning between 9 and 10 for the Sundance Reel, and the first weekend of the festival from 8 to 10 to hear from filmmakers, producers, and film critics. That's the Sundance Reel through January 30th, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Sponsored by Sky Wellness Collection.
Hi, I'm Maren Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about? And you thought it was only recycling. We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board, as always. He's shaking his head. And here in the studio with us this morning are Sean Kelleher and Preston Campbell. And they're the developer and the general contractor for a new eco-friendly community on Rossi Hill, right here in Park City, called the Echo Spur. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Nell.
Thanks.
We're happy to have you here. So let's just start by... will you give us a description of your motivation for this project and a little bit about your background?
Sure, I'll give a real quick background. I've been involved with the project now for probably about 8 or 9 years. We've gone through a couple different review processes and thought this through pretty carefully. Have built a pretty big team of engineers and architects, and Preston has been the driving force in terms of the building strategy. But when you really look at what we're doing, it really comes down just to kind of common sense economics. These are all strategies that maybe aren't out there broadly in the marketplace, but really just make sense economically and financially to put into a new home these days.
How many homes are we talking about?
There will be 7 homes up there when we're completed.
This is in the Rossi Hill section.
Exactly. Literally 200 yards from where we sit.
Right up there. Okay. And what size are these homes?
Most homes will be around 2,700 square feet. A couple will be around 3,500 or 3,600.
Okay.
So I'm curious, it's pretty frequent that you hear something about a sustainable development or green homes or, you know, sustainability features. But Chris and I tend to, you know, laugh a little bit. A lot of the times we feel like, oh, this commitment isn't really
a bit of greenwashing
in place. So there's a little bit of greenwashing. But you guys have kind of taken a lot of these sustainability features as high as you could. So give us the overview of some of the most important features of these homes.
You guys call it greenwashing. We call it vanity green. We see a lot of that. People will put two PV panels on the roof, or, you know, a solar collector for their hot water that provides 10% of their hot water needs, and feel like they're going green. But for
I
us,
call it minty green.
Minty green, exactly.
Versus emerald green.
For us, it really comes down to the long-term energy requirements to keep a family happy and comfortable in a house like the ones we're building. And, you know, it really is unsustainable, the amount of energy that we're using in this country, and so much of it goes to heat and power the houses, and we just don't need to use that much. We're not looking to reduce the comfort level. We're just looking to save the energy that goes into the house, and a big part of that is insulation. So, if I had to pick one thing from the building standpoint of what I've pushed for is hyper-insulation. You know, you pay once to warm the thing up. Let's keep that energy inside the building envelope where it belongs.
What's the standard insulation around here?
A lot lower than you would think. You know, you can get by
pink
with
fiberglass?
Yeah, a lot of people are still using it. It's amazing. I'll walk into a project and see somebody still using bad insulation. That stuff should have been banned, you know, 30 years ago. In a laboratory, it works okay. Mm-hmm. In field environments, when you see how it's actually applied, the stuff is horrible. So much of the detail of how it's put in just doesn't work out. So it should at least be blown insulation. But we're really in favor of rigid foam on the exterior of the envelope.
So I was just going to ask, what does super insulation mean?
Well, we're in the 40s or 50s even in the walls. And, you know,
40s or 50s meaning?
Oh, sorry, R value.
Okay.
Which, yeah. You're an engineer. You right. know how that works. I'm happy to explain it if you want me to.
But pink fiberglass insulation is what R value?
Well, in a 2x6 wall, you'll get maybe, in theory, an R19.
Okay. So now you're up 2 to 3 times
exactly.
that with maybe, foam.
That's what we're aiming for, yes.
Rigid foam.
Correct.
Okay. Not blown in.
No, this came down from the Canadians, and they're using it a lot in Alaska. We're using big panels of white. It's basically returning your house into an igloo cooler on the exterior. Especially up here, there's so much steel and wood in the walls. The blown in, it doesn't matter what you do. If you put it in the stud cavity, only half of the wall gets filled. The rest of it is solid material.
Okay.
Maybe one way to kind of put that in practical terms, too, is that the typical home out there, you know, the exterior air moves through your house multiple times an hour in a house that's even 30 or 40 years old. So you've got no control over what's coming into your house, and therefore you're spending a lot more money on heating or air conditioning to manage that. With the strategies that Preston has used in these homes, we're controlling the interior air, we're controlling that environment, and you're not spending all that money just to pump heat into the house to keep the cold air out.
Great. So what are some of the other features that you guys worked on?
Well, one of the newer ones is the use of a water system. We've got a cistern that's buried in the backyard, and a couple of years ago that was not legal in Utah, so there are very few homes that do that. And we did the math. We hired a local landscape architect named Seth Bachhold, who kind of did all the numbers and all the analytics for us, and we spent a lot of time just looking at the numbers and determined that for the cost of a 2,500-gallon cistern buried in our backyard, we can take all of the snow and water coming off the roof of the house, because we do have a flat roof, it's a green roof, and all that flows down into our cistern, and then we just pump it right back up to irrigate the roof and the rest of the property. So that's one of the newer things that we've incorporated here.
And that's, like you say, that's recent, because a few years ago, it was against the law?
Literally against the law in Utah to do that.
To have a cistern,
yes.
Or any type of rain barrel,
yeah,
beyond a certain volume.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now you got
exactly.
2,500 gallons. That's a pretty good size tank to hold water. That's great.
Well, that's the biggest they would let us have. We wanted more, but we're
greedy. That's the limit right now.
Right now it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what were some of the other, you know, barriers that you guys ran into? There were some features and some, I don't know, some functionality that you wanted to add that you weren't able to.
Well, I would throw that to Sean, because he's well known for sending emails at 1 o'clock in the morning of, have you read this article and what do you think about this? So he really pushed the envelope of what we needed to research and find out how it would work. And, you know, we've been trying to push it here, but he's really gathered kind of a worldwide perspective of they're doing this in Bali. Have you seen this new thing? What do you think about this new
passive house design elements or so?
You know, we experimented with getting that close, and we're going to be close to net zero. The passive house design really requires, I think, too small a building envelope to work here in Park City.
Okay, you touched on something I'm gonna get to in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. But how about let's talk about some of the other elements. Or I'm sorry, no, you talk about some of the things that you wanted to do with, say, sharing PV based solar.
Power. The most interesting thing that I think is technically feasible, but from a regulatory perspective isn't allowed, is to literally be able to share your solar PV between homes. Now, Park City is obviously an environment, at least Old Town, where the majority of the homes are second homes, vacation homes. You can put solar panels on the roof of those homes across the entire district, and you could literally share energy between homes. Now, when you go through all the math of that, you're basically taking care of all of your PV needs in Old Town, but you're using a lot fewer solar panels than you would if each individual home had to do it themselves. We share lots of things in communities. We share property taxes to run the schools and things like that. It's kind of a foreign concept to be sharing your PV, but technically it's actually doable. And, you know, Park City just was selected for this Georgetown University energy competition. Right. And there's some, you know, this is a longer range idea, but there's lots of things like that that, if the regulatory environment was a little bit more conducive, I think people would be moving a lot faster, moving forward a lot more quickly with some of these ideas.
So one other thing that you had thought about was geothermal, but that didn't end up being part of the project. What was the story behind that?
Well, we actually had the drilling rig showing up ready to start drilling, and one of the city representatives stopped by and said, oh, you know, you're not allowed to do geothermal. And we said, well, it was in the plans. And they basically negotiated with us and said we could have it for the first few, but they weren't going to let us do it for the rest of them. City Council is now stopping all geothermal drilling, is our understanding, through the city engineer's office. So not wanting to be in any kind of a adversarial relationship with them, plus not wanting to have something for some of the houses that we couldn't have for all of them, we decided not to do the geothermal, which we understand they're wanting to protect the water source, and we obviously support that, but we would like to have seen geothermal. We're doing that in quite a few projects in the county, and it's working really well.
Oh, good. That's good to know, because I'll be curious, interested to know what the city's position is on that.
And so we'd like some more clarity from that as well, and I don't think it's available quite yet, but just the fact that it was in flux, we were afraid to push for it. But in the county, in projects there, we're using it for heating and for cooling.
Right. That's the beauty of geothermal. Right.
And if you have PV on the roof, then the geothermal becomes literally free.
Right. Okay.
Except for the upfront cost, which are substantive.
Okay. How about windows? You have passive solar. Now, these homes are oriented on an east-west fashion, right? So, you know, the prime area for passive solar is a southern-oriented window or so. So you're limited in that. But do you have double pane, triple pane windows or so? Are they included?
We've got a really high efficiency window, but if it's okay with you, I'd like to back up just for 1 second, because the north-south orientation of the street did pose some challenges, especially because the street falls to the north.
Yeah.
So each house is blocked from the sun by the one to the south of it, in theory.
Oh,
but the architect worked very hard to come up with a plan that minimized that effect. And unfortunately, your windows are facing the wrong way. But if this studio was facing up the hill, you could see this project.
Yeah.
It's on the sunny side of the hill. We can watch the sun. We're up there framing now. We can watch the sun go down behind Park City Mountain, and we're still in the sun.
Right.
So we're taking
Full advantage of that western aspect.
The western facing windows have a different solar heat gain coefficient than the other windows in the house. The floors are thickened concrete where we collect solar energy during the day and let it radiate passively back out to the house during the night.
Is it radiant heating?
They are.
Floor-based radiant heating.
Radiant heating and cooling.
Okay, good.
So you put so many different features into these and so much thought. Did you guys attach or apply for a rating from any of the available rating systems along the lines of LEED?
We are in the process of doing exactly that. So we are doing the LEED certification, NAHB certification, and we're also doing what we think is really kind of the simplest, which is the HERS rating. And the HERS rating is kind of like, it's the same thing as kind of your miles per gallon in your car. It's a good kind of very simple quantitative tool to let you know, what your energy consumption is relative to kind of the building standards. So we are, you know, a zero index would be you're using basically it's a passive house.
Right.
Right. 100 is kind of the standard, for a new home. Most existing homes are probably 130 is their index. You know, we think we're going to be somewhere around a 20 for our HERS index.
Wow. Okay. Now, is that also a function of the owner's behavior patterns too? I mean, it's one thing to look, you've got solar, you know, passive window, you know, high efficiency windows, and you've got super insulation, you've got maybe a high efficiency appliances and lighting and all the, you give them all these things, but if they leave all the lights on and set the thermostat at 78, you know, that's kind of defeating the purpose. This is a behavioral thing. So that's a challenge.
The one great thing about the HERS rating is that it's all third-party verified. So you have a real test, a real, you know, verified tester that comes in and rates everything.
Right.
They do a blower door test where they put a big fan against the front door and see how much air infiltration there is in the house. They check all of your energy. But I agree with you that the final occupant's behavior can have a big impact on that. And that is not included in the HERS rating. And honestly, I don't know how it ever would be.
No, and you're right. I have just the opposite situation. I do my best to use as little energy as possible. But my HERS rating at my condo at the Racquet Club Village is about a 230.
Right.
Because I don't think there's any insulation. I wish I had pink fiberglass in a couple of rooms, but I believe there's none. So, but that was the construction techniques and methodologies back in the 70s or so when those things were built, right? You're nodding.
Sure, and I think that's absolutely true. But I think also what we've tried to do too is establish a lot of these new strategies that are as passive as possible. So super insulation, you know, you're not going to have to worry about that.
Critical.
The green roof and the cistern and the water system, in theory, you don't ever have to touch that. So this isn't like you've got to go and crank open windows and move your drapes around. This is, you know, we tried to build this in a way where the owner doesn't know any differently what his energy usage is than he would in a standard house.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that brings up a good point. You know, who do you see buying these homes? Is it the hardcore hemp-wearing environmentalist, or is it somebody that's just looking for a cool house in Old Town? Or, you know, who do you see buying these?
Well, I mean, you use the word environmentalist. I think it's kind of an accidental environmentalist, because I think that's a concept where people just understand that these things are all to their benefit, you know, both maybe ethically as well as financially. So they don't really think too hard about that, but they just know it's in their best interest. The buyers we think are going to be, you know, a lot of folks that are maybe empty nesters who want to stay in Park City, maybe get closer to Park City, someone who's moving in from Pinebrook. And the kids are out of the house, and they don't need to have five bedrooms and 5,000 square or 6,000 square feet. That's probably a typical buyer.
Great.
Yes. But here's where I push back a bit. On the buyer, not on you guys, okay? So what I'm about to say is it's not an indictment on what you guys are doing, but an indictment on the clients, the customers out there. Because I believe they'd want energy efficiency, and we're going to talk numbers. Because there's a real economic value associated with this. But I also believe that these clients want energy-efficient homes, energy-efficient appliances, solar panels where they can, cisterns. But they still want 3,500 square feet. They might be empty nesters, but they still want four bedrooms, you know, when the kids visit. And they still want their comfort. And so it doesn't really fit into what I consider to be a sustainable home. It's not a sustainable design. Not everyone can live like this with a two or two and a half, person per home, but it's still 3,500 square feet. And until the HERS index or others lead starts taking into account the footprint of the home, I don't think we have truly sustainable values going on here.
And I agree with that. But if we made these 800 square feet like the Germans are doing with their passive houses, nobody would buy it. And so it would be okay.
And I agree with you. And I would say, how about 1,200? How about 1,500? How about 1,800 square feet? When are we going to see homes in this town that a developer says, you know what, I'm going to build 1,500 to 1,800 foot cottages, nice, energy efficient, modern cottages that are just two bedroom, two bath. That's it.
I'll tell you when I think that's going to happen, when all of this technology becomes more mass-produced and therefore less expensive. Because right now, a geothermal system might cost $50,000 or $75,000. And if you spread that over 1,000 square feet, it's just it's unaffordable.
That's a big nut. But we have a few more minutes. Let's talk about so you talked about all these elements, components, super insulation. What's the added cost compared to a standard home in either dollars or percentage? What am I paying up front?
You know, it's a substantive number. Sean's hoping it'll be 3-5%. I think it could be as much as 10%.
Okay.
But that's already factored into the cost of of these houses. And Sean's the money guy. He can tell you the return of that.
Sean. Yeah, but so for an extra 10%, what am I getting on the back end as far as my monthly bills?
Yeah, so just to kind of really break it down. So, for example, if you look at, the cost of the solar panels and what that saves you in terms of electricity every month, you're probably talking about a return on investment of somewhere in the single digits. These days, that's not a terrible return when you can put your money in the bank and basically get zero, or the stock market and take more risk there and long term maybe earn 6 or 7. So it's getting competitive with the alternative of just leaving it in a financial instrument. The cistern, and the green roof, that's a little more complicated because you've kind of created this little environment where the real cost might be upwards of $25,000 or $30,000 just for the structure itself.
Right.
There's some other kind of there's more engineering you have to do in terms of the framing, but that's also kind of a quality of life issue, as well as you are going to save a couple $1,000s a year likely on water bills. If you want to build your own vegetable garden on your roof, you can do that.
Right. That's optional, right? The green roof is optional?
No, the green roof, we're putting those on there because the land management code in Park City says if you want a flat roof, it has to be a green roof.
Really?
And circling back to the issue about the orientation of the homes, because of that orientation, the flat roof makes it easier for us to orient our panels to the optimal position for the sun.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to throw in one other thing, too, about the cost, because people are so, we get a lot of people that will come to us and say, what's your rate of return? Right. How long will it take me to pay off this solar panel? How long will it take me to pay off the super insulation? And my argument to that is, forget the cash on cash value of it. When you go to sell this house 10 years from now, you won't be able to sell your house if it's not built to these modern standards, because it's coming. Every house is going to be forced to that. When you look at how much cars are better today than they were 10 years ago, and our industry just hasn't changed. Most people are building today exactly the same way that you built your racket club condo. With just a little bit more insulation, you'd be shocked at how little most houses have. And those houses are going to be very difficult to move 10 or 15 years from now when everyone demands. You would never buy a new car today without asking what the MPG rating is. And 30 years ago, it wasn't even available.
Right.
And that's coming for houses. When it does get here, that most of the houses that are built today are going to have to be retrofitted before they can be sold, and that's going to be very expensive.
So you anticipated my next question really well. Chris is laughing about how he'll never be able to sell his home now.
The value of my
sell
place.
It now quickly and buy one of Sean's.
I just reduced the value of my place by 10%. Good job,
We
Chris.
Will be posting Chris's address on our Facebook page. But I wanted to ask, where do you think this is going? And is anyone else doing this right now? Do we have other, sustainable developments coming online in Park City or Summit County or Utah?
You call it mint green, right?
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of that.
Is there? But is there a trend, at least, that you see other developers, architects, GCs, slowly embracing, again, the
even
value,
in other states or regions,
the benefits.
Well, the Home Builders Association, which I'm a part of, has been pushing that, and we've been doing quite a bit of education. To be honest, the turnout has been really disappointingly low. we'll bring a, you know, an expert in from Canada and have four or five builders come to the class. There should be, every builder in town should be forced to come to those classes.
And it shouldn't be green building. You shouldn't have to go around and say, this is a green building, this is an eco-friend. No, this is a building. This is a home. And this is what it comes with. And this is what it costs. And this is the value of that.
Well, the rating system will fix that.
Okay. All right. Hey, Sean Keller and Preston Campbell are our developer and the general contractor for the EchoSpur development going up. Two homes in the process of being constructed right now?
Yes.
Okay. And then another five after that?
And then when do you expect these to be available?
Well, the first two will be done this summer. And then we will kind of keep kind of moving down the street and just probably do a couple a year, kind of learn as we go a little bit about what people want. But right now, two should be ready by the summer.
Good. Website people can go to learn more?
EchoSpur.com.
And that's ECHO, not ECCO. So it's ECHOSPUR.com.
Perfect. All right, Sean Kelleher and Preston Campbell, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on and chat about this. Really, it's a really interesting topic. I know I get a little exercised at times because I've seen enough, Nell and I have seen enough greenwashing, the minty green types of development that are out there that are championing themselves as green builders. And you dig into the details and they're far from it. And so... So that's what.
So we're happy to see what you're doing, is what Chris is trying to say.
That you're making efforts. And I really do want to explore some more about what's going on with respect to geothermal issues and why that's a challenge or what the city's position is. We're going to look into that. All right?
Thanks for having me.
Thanks,
thanks, thanks so much.
Thank you. Hey, let's take a break for some sponsors and underwriters. And when we come back, it'll be Mary Krista Smith from the Summit Community Power Works. She's the project manager. We're going to be talking about light bulbs and some myths and realities associated with the ban, the quote-unquote banning of incandescent light bulbs. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
The HOA law firm Morris Berry proudly supports KPCW. Morris Berry is hosting a seminar about how to be a good condo or HOA board member. Tuesday, January 13th, 6:30 p.m., Red Rock Brewery. Board members and HOA managers are invited, but space is limited. Registration information at 435-575-9000 or morrisberry.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. And that's the conversation we just had.
That's right. That was the first half.
That was really interesting.
That will also be the second half.
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue. Yes. Some talk about environmental issues and concepts of sustainability with Mary Krista Smith. She is the project manager with Summit Community Power Works, a recent nonprofit organization that was formed to pursue the Georgetown University Energy Prize, which Sean Kelleher actually mentioned as part of what he was talking about, the sharing of solar power between homes and the problem Rocky Mountain Power has with that. But anyway, I digress. Mary Krista, thanks for coming on the show and talk about what the SCPW is all about. And also we're going to get into some light bulb conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's a little background. What is the Georgetown University Energy Prize?
The Georgetown University Energy Prize is a $5 million incentive for the community that can lead the way in energy efficiency. And they are launching officially tomorrow. We have a representative from Georgetown who will be on the NewsHour tomorrow morning to make that official announcement about the final communities. And we are really excited. We feel confident that we will be in the finals and look forward to that announcement.
How many cities are involved in this?
We think they will have whittled it down to 50 cities, and they're hoping to tap our imagination, our creativity, and our innovation through this incentive prize to make a leap in this country in regards to energy efficiency.
Okay, energy efficiency in terms of just using less electricity and natural gas in our homes, right? So it's a contest that says, hey, how much can a community reduce its electricity use and natural gas use over a 2-year period, right?
Yes.
Starting January 1st of this year.
Yes.
Okay. And then they're going to somehow compare us with other communities like Aspen,
Jackson Hole,
Palo Alto. All right. I was thinking Atlantic City, Winter Park, Florida.
Holland, Michigan.
Okay. So all these communities, small communities, not big cities, they have to be less than 250,000 people in population. So that's who we're competing against.
Yes. And they've chosen that size of population because most of us in the United States live in a community of that size. And also $5 million makes a big difference to a community our size. And they wanted that to be a huge incentive.
And so how is this tracked or graded? How are we judged in this competition?
We are judged at the meter. And so we have partnered with Rocky Mountain Power and Questar, who are providing the data to Georgetown University, and they aggregate the data. So they take the total number of kilowatt hours and divide it by the total number of residential accounts in the county to determine if we are making reductions over time. And they will post these on their website quarterly so we can see how we are ranking against the other communities. And we're hoping to draw upon Summit County's competitive spirit to motivate our residents to make those changes, big and small.
Right. Very competitive community.
Yes.
And so that'll be to our advantage.
Yes,
once we
absolutely
start posting those dashboards. I'm on the executive committee with the SCPW. So we have lots of initiatives or plans or programs we're going to be rolling out over the course of these 2 years to kind of educate and incentivize, like you say, Mary Krista, incentivize people to see the value of first figuring out how much electricity they consume, how much natural gas they consume, how much of that is wasted, and then cut back on that waste. So this is about using less without taking a vow of poverty. You know, this is not living in the dark.
Well, we're fortunate.
Although that's appreciated.
That's an option.
If we want to win $5 million,
by all means.
I think rolling brownouts is one of our last options.
We're fortunate because the technology is at a point where we can make a difference. And for example, with light bulbs, put in LED light bulbs and reduce our consumption of electricity and still have wonderful quality of light. And we don't have to take a vow of poverty. Thank you. Thanks to the technology that's available today.
This is about mining inefficiencies. We're a mining town. This is about mining inefficiencies in the electricity and natural gas we use. Okay. So that's the thing. If we do really well and if we're innovative and replicable so that our ideas and programs can travel to other communities around Utah or so, then we get $5 million to be used for what?
The $5 million will go into a foundation that will, through the interest, continue the work of Summit Community PowerWorks in perpetuity. And so we hope to learn what works, what doesn't work, and so that at the end of the 2 years, when we win the prize and collect the $5 million, we will be able to put our best practices into practice
continually to spread them and replicate them nationwide and to continue to invest $250,000, $1 million a year back into Summit County to continue energy efficiency programs.
Right. And again, this is countywide.
Yes,
countywide. Not just Park City. This is countywide. Okay. So one of the big components that Georgetown is looking for is in the area of education, not just educating out to residents or businesses or so. And by the way, businesses aren't in play with respect to metering their energy use, correct?
That is correct. Only residents and municipal buildings. So the city hall will be in play.
Right.
But
the resorts are not.
Resorts are not.
Correct. Restaurants are not.
Correct.
Schools
what
are.
What about nonprofits? KPCW?
I think you're on a commercial meter.
Yes. Okay.
Not a residential meter.
Given the fact we have 6,500 nonprofits in this town, they're not included. So the Swanner, is it included?
Swanner is not included.
So you don't worry now.
All right, we'll just keep hogging all the energy use over there at the Eco Center, installing halogen features. And
exactly. Okay, but going back to the education, school districts are in play.
Yes,
and their meters will be monitored.
Yes, they are. And not only are we measuring the data from the school districts as far as are they able to make reductions in their energy consumption, but we are also asked by Georgetown to engage the students K through 12. And so there's an educational component that takes place from the inside out within the schools so that the students increase their awareness. Where does energy come from? And to educate them about inefficiency and create curricula that's tied to the Common Core that also is tied to the STEM curricula standards statewide, and then have those students take that information and those ideas that they're learning out into their families, their neighborhoods, and out into the community.
Oh, that's great. So we're going to be developing curriculum for to be used in the classroom on energy efficiency, energy use, energy waste, et cetera.
We've already had teachers from South Summit School District as well as from Ecker Hill and the Weilerman School who've already begun the process of contributing curriculum. And I had a meeting yesterday with the PACE teachers in the Park City School District, and they are very excited about the opportunity to dovetail Summit Community PowerWorks Initiative for Energy Efficiency along with their curricula as well. So we hope to expand it into every school, into every classroom, in creative ways that support what the teachers are doing that are tied to the Common Core as well.
Okay. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Mary Krista Smith. She is the project manager for the Summit Community PowerWorks. That's the a nonprofit organization that has been formed to pursue the Georgetown University Energy Prize, a $5 million winner-take-all X Prize to the community that reduces its energy use in terms of electricity and natural gas, the most over the two-year period beginning January 1st. We're on our way.
We're already in. They're measuring.
Okay, and our first initiative that's going to be rolled out, like you say, the formal rollout is tomorrow. Correct.
That's correct.
The formal. All right. Is a LED light bulb program. Let's talk a little bit about that, and then
yes,
we'll get into some of the myths associated with LEDs and incandescents.
Yes. We have chosen, as you know, Chris, the LED light bulbs as the easiest change that people can make. And we call it the LED switch. And we're asking every resident in Summit County to look up, look around, notice your light bulbs, and to make that change to install LED light bulbs. They have come down in cost greatly over the last couple of years. They used to cost upwards of $10. And I think you were at Home Depot the other day, Chris, and saw them for...
I bought a 40-watt equivalent LED bulb for $4.
$4.
It was on sale for $4. So the prices have really come down.
So one thing that we often think with the LEDs is that they're, you know, of course, they're really expensive, but we know that those prices have come down. Mm-hmm. They're really difficult to install, or you need special hardware. Where do we stand on that?
Well, the light bulbs that I have that are LED install just like a regular incandescent bulb. So there's no difficulty there. They're compatible with your everyday light fixtures. Mm-hmm. The color on them is really nice. I cannot tell the difference between the color of my LED bulbs and the color of my incandescent bulbs, which is not necessarily true of CFLs or compact fluorescents, which tend to be a little bit cold, not to mention the mercury that's in those light bulbs, right, which is why we're asking people to change those out as well.
Right, when they can, because they're efficient.
They are.
They're more efficient than incandescents, yes, but the LEDs are better. But now LED, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, you know, how much energy are we saving with these when you take an incandescent versus a fluorescent versus an LED? What's the payoff here?
What's the numbers?
The numbers are, comparing an LED light bulb to an incandescent light bulb, that they are 80% more efficient on average. So for every dollar you're spending on electricity that's related to your lighting, you would only spend 20 cents. People who have changed their light bulbs in their homes, depending on how much of their energy use comes from lighting, have seen between a 20% and 40% reduction in their electricity bill just from changing their light bulbs out.
Right. So again, for a 60-watt incandescent bulb, if I replace that with what's called a 60-watt equivalent LED, that's going to provide the same amount of light, you know, on a lumen per lumen basis, lighting basis, that LED only uses like 6 to 8 watts.
Wow.
So it's one eighth to 1/9 less. So that's what Merry Christmas was saying. I mean, it's a dramatic difference. And in fact, the 40-watt bulb, LED bulb that I bought, replaced a 60-watt lamp bulb, and that's how much the light, the brightness that's given off. So you don't even need a 60 by 60 equivalent. If you want, you can go even lower in an LED.
Okay, a couple other comparison points that I want. How about length of time that these bulbs last? And then also, like you mentioned, the mercury in fluorescent bulbs, is there any special way that we need to dispose of these LED mm-hmm. bulbs once we've got them in place?
As far as your first question and length of time, they compare the life of one LED light bulb would be comparable to 42 incandescent bulbs, so that you would change your incandescent bulbs 42 times for every one LED you would install. On the upper end, they last 50,000 hours.
Wow.
So my grandchildren years. Could be changing these bulbs.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. The second question, Nell.
A CFL disposal. Let me take that, okay, as an environmental
Chris,
engineer.
Are you hogging airtime?
Yes. Well, just with the disposal thing, it's not a big deal, okay? People think, whoa, you dropped that CFL on the floor, it breaks. You know, you got to call a hazmat squad and EPA. No. No, you don't have to do that. It's mercury. There's mercury gas in there. It's not much, okay? So if you drop it on the floor, it breaks. You open up the doors or windows, let things air out, sweep it up, put it into a plastic bag, wrap that plastic bag into another plastic bag, double bag it or so, and throw it away. Okay, it doesn't require hazmat teams and 55-gallon drums and, you know, Action News come to your home. No, it's
do not call 911.
Okay, and now if that bulb burns out, and then just again double wrap it in plastic, and throw it away. It's
actually
okay.
I'm going to encourage you to take it to the recycle center. INSA Repin has a bin where you can bring your unbroken CFL bulbs. And they will dispose of them in an environmentally friendly way.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Recycle Utah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, we got a few more minutes. We wanted to get to some other myths, okay, incandescent bulb myths. Because back in 2007, the President Bush at the time, signed a proclamation or a bill called the Energy Independence and Security Act, or ESA. And among other things, that would require the phasing out of certain incandescent bulbs, 40, 60, 75, and 100-watt standard incandescent bulbs, okay? The idea was that those bulbs are very inefficient in their lighting, because typically 90% of the electricity that those bulbs consume is just turned to heat. Only 10% is actually turned to light. If you don't believe me, go ahead and touch a bulb, a 75-watt bulb that's been on for, say, 30 minutes, and you will burn yourself. But it will drop a little drop of water on the bulb, and it will sizzle. It's hundreds and hundreds of degrees at its top of its element. That's how inefficient those bulbs are. So they were phased out. A lot of people reacted to that this was, you know, anti-capitalist and un-American, and Texas is going to make its own Texas bulb, incandescent bulb. I swear to you, Michelle Bachmann introduced the anti-light bulb, anti-incandescent bulb act or something. Failed. But so here's some of the myths associated with this act, all right? First of all, incandescent bulbs would become illegal. That's not true. Those standard old-fashioned bulbs are being phased out. More efficient incandescent bulbs that use turn more energy into light and less heat are coming on the market. Three-way bulbs, they're still incandescent. Right, and landscape lighting is still an incandescent bulb, so the incandescent bulbs are still out there. Halogen bulbs that you mentioned, those are actually a type of incandescent bulb. They're more efficient because they have halogen gas inside the bulb, so they burn more efficient. They burn pretty hot too, but they're more efficient types of incandescent bulbs. So it's not a ban, you know, of incandescent. It's just a phasing out and a replacement, like Mary Chris was saying, with a more efficient type of bulb. Okay, so that's one. Here's another one. Consumers will spend more on bulbs. Well, back in 2008 and 2009, 2010, LEDs were expensive when they first came out. They were $10 to $12 to $15 per bulb for a 60-watt or a 75-watt bulb. That's you know, when an incandescent was going for $1.50, who's going to do that? Well, now LEDs have dropped in price, like we were saying. The 40-watt bulb was on sale at the big box store for $4. 60 watts or $5 or $6. That is much more the competition, right? GE, Philips, Cree. I recommend, if we don't make a shame, Cree. I like Cree bulbs because they are well made and they're US made. So you know their quality assurance, quality control is good. Good bulbs. So anyway, that's another, the prices come down dramatically, LEDs.
And when you consider that one LED bulb is the equivalent of 42 incandescent bulbs, it just makes sense from a financial point of view. And if you're only talking about a $4, $5, $6 upfront cost, I think that's easy for most families to make that adjustment.
Yeah. Now I'm starting by, I just went through my house and I have like 45 separate sources of light, you know, in my place. It's amazing how many sources of light we have. But I just figured out which lights do I use the most, and those are the ones I'm starting with. So my kitchen lights and my desk light, that's where I'm starting. I'm phasing it in because I'm not going to go and swap out all 45 lights with LEDs. I can't afford that. But I can afford to buy one or two or three and get things going. And that has the greatest impact on my savings because those, yes, are the lights I use the most. Okay. Oh, one final myth. People say LEDs won't be available in dimmers. They're dimmable.
Yes,
that's
they are
another
dimmable.
Advancement in technology. It's a big one.
Yes.
That's a big one. So you can use a dimmable LEDs and CFLs, et cetera.
I can personally attest to that. I have an LED bulb on a lamp that is dimmable, and it works great, and the lighting is wonderful.
Good.
And even if everyone only changes one bulb, that makes a difference. Or change, as Chris said, the bulbs that you use the most. Or change out all your bulbs except your CFLs. Or really go for it and change every single bulb in your house. But each one of those steps matter.
Yes.
And what matters is action. We can talk about it and we can understand the cost-benefit savings and it makes sense. But what really counts is if you're willing to get up on that chair and take out the old light bulb and go put a new one in. And we're asking people to take that action that makes the difference and that helps us win that $5 million prize.
Okay. There you go. That's the Summit Community PowerWorks summary for today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to be hearing more. Thank you, Mary Chris. We're going to be hearing more from you.
Will there be further initiatives throughout the year?
Yes, we have three other initiatives that we will be rolling out. So this is the LED switch, and we are going to have a thermostat switch. There is data that suggests if we were to have all programmable thermostats in our homes, we would reduce our consumption of natural gas by 20%. Our third initiative has to do with weatherization and retrofitting, insulation, windows, weather stripping.
Mm-hmm. Big one.
All those foundational pieces of our homes, heating and cooling systems. And our final one is renewables and helping people to facilitate the process to make it easy for people to make that switch to renewable sources of energy, like Summit Community Solar has done in the past.
All right. And
fantastic.
And I have my own personal crusade as a member of the executive committee that I'm going to be on. It's the heat tape crusade.
Oh, I thought that was going to be the hot tub crusade.
The hot tub and heat tape. Actually, how about that? HT, the HT squared crusade. Heat tapes and hot tubs. You think we can save energy on lighting and thermostats? You won't believe how much energy we waste in this community on hot tubs and heat tape running when they don't need to be. But our behavior says, oh, just leave them on. I'll be posting on that on the SCPW website, which is going to be launched soon too, right, Mary Krista?
Yes. We're looking forward to your blog post, Chris.
All right. Well, we got to get going. We'll have you on. We'll be launching tomorrow. There'll be more interviews, et cetera. Mary Krista Smith, Project Manager with the Summit Community Powerworks. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Nell. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Let's, you know what? We only got a minute or so. We'll take a break. I want to get to one of these news items.
I vote that we cover the Petco news item.
All right, here we go.
So Chris and I have long had a philosophy, if it comes from China, don't put it in your mouth.
Exactly. And here's your pet's mouth. Are you ready for this? Petco last week has removed all remaining Chinese-made dog and cat treats from its website, thank you, and stores, better, nationwide because of concerns they have that have sickened thousands of pets and killed more than 1,000 dogs in the U.S. since 2007. Now, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration says initial tests have not connected the Chinese jerky and rawhide treats to these illnesses, but the San Diego-based company, that's Petco, and its rival PetSmart both vowed back in May to ban the snacks. They're finally clearing their shelves of it. Petco is the first national pet retailer to pull the treats from its 1,300 stores. Phoenix-based PetSmart said it plans to have them off the shelves in its 1,300 stores by March, meaning that's when they'll all be sold.
That's right.
Petco has been actively reducing their China-made assortment and expanding their American-made offerings for several years. And it will go good because don't eat stuff. Don't give your pets food from China.
There's been a long line of contamination with arsenic and heavy metals and just about everything you can imagine.
Okay. Let's see. Again, the FDA hasn't specifically linked these treats, the illnesses, but here's just this last sentence. Tests have not confirmed any connection, but the agency is still investigating. Meanwhile, the number of cases continue to climb, with illness reported in more than 5,600 dogs, 25 cats, and are you ready for this? 3 humans as of October. That's the pet owner that gets down on all fours. Oh, it's so good. Look, it's yummy. It puts it in your mouth, and then smash cut to hospital emergency room. All I had was a dog treat.
Yeah.
From China. All right. We got to thank our underwriters. We got to go. We're running out of time.
Thank Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
and Vail Resorts.
Join us on Facebook, KPCW This Green Earth. And you can email us your thoughts also at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.